On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman was convicted of ruthlessly murdering her husband.
There's some rope cord, and they put it around Mr. Spinagle's neck, and they each take one end of the rope and begin to pull.
I didn't have anything to do with it. I was a bystander.
Then Carmen Ortiz tells her story. She was an accomplice in a senseless killing for drugs.
He was like, oh my God, I think I, killed somebody.
The next thing I know, he's lunging at me, trying to cut my face or stab me in the neck with a knife.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Delpha Spinagle and Carmen Ortiz. On August 20th, 1993, police discovered the badly decomposed body of 40-year-old Dennis Spinagle in a creek bed, 50 feet from County Line Road.
It looked like the body was moving and boiling. It was so covered with insects and maggots.
To kill somebody is bad enough, but to torture that poor man for 4 hours or so, the way he was tortured, was unforgivable.
Investigators arrested two people, including 44-year-old Delpha Spinagle, Dennis's wife, and accused her of orchestrating his murder.
There's no way she could have helped assist in killing anybody. She couldn't have.
Was Delpha Spinagle forced to participate in the gruesome murder of her husband? Or did she scheme to have him killed for money? Delpha Bond grew up in southeastern Oklahoma as the youngest of four sisters.
I had a very supportive family and just a normal childhood.
All four girls would be in the kitchen and they would be laughing and it's just the happiest atmosphere that you want to be around.
I was the baby of the family, and I was spoiled by my sisters and my parents.
In fact, Delpha became the apple of her father's eye.
He cared so much for her because he was proud of her at school. She was smart and got everything. And, well, she was just always a loving, caring kid.
By the time Delpha reached high school, she had blossomed into an attractive and popular young lady.
She was a beautician. The boys in her class, they all just loved her.
One of those boyfriends became Delpha's first love.
I was a junior in high school. His name was Gary. He was very good looking, charming. Everything that you want in a high school sweetheart.
After graduating as valedictorian of her high school class, Delpha enrolled in cosmetology school and married Gary.
I was rather spoiled, so I was used to having things my way. And of course, when you get married, things change. But I didn't change with it.
At age 21, after just 3 years of marriage, Delpha filed for divorce.
I couldn't have children, and that just pretty well set the tone for the marriage. I asked him to move out.
Delpha married two more times and eventually had two children, a boy and a girl. After 8 years of marriage to her third husband, she divorced again.
I loaded up my car, baby bed and all, and took off. Went and moved to another town. Everywhere I moved, my dad would build me a beauty shop so I wouldn't have to get out of the house.
I think she was looking for someone like her dad, a father-like figure and someone that loved kids and worked hard and was concerned about family, and none of those fit the spot.
So my life went on just like it was. Had more responsibility with two kids, but it was worth it.
She hated the fact that she was married as many times as she was. She felt embarrassed. She was still hunting for the right person that would complement her life.
Then, when Delpha was 36 years old, she met 32-year-old Dennis Spinagle.
He was good looking. He was quiet. He was hardworking. He was everything that I was looking for at the time.
In 1986, the couple married.
He just told me that, she said, I'm gonna make this work no matter what. I don't ever want to think that I'm just jumped from marriage to marriage to marriage and never satisfied.
He was just the perfect husband. He was real good to my family, and he was just a good man, I thought.
The couple started a silk screening business and bought a home in Edmond. But when her father died in 1988, Delpha says Dennis started drinking heavily and physically abusing her.
He had gotten drunk several times before that, but had never done anything. I think he was afraid of my father, so he never did lay a hand on me until after my dad had died.
Delpha recalls the first time Dennis allegedly hit her.
He came home drunk one evening, and he proceeded to start hitting on me. I was in shock when it happened.
To add insult to injury, Delpha says Dennis was also having an affair with a barmaid.
I went to the bar one time with her to see if he was really in there, and which he was, and with this girl. And she said, well, let's just leave him alone. So there's nothing you can do about it.
But according to the police, rather than walk away from another failing marriage, Delpha hatched a deadly plan to get rid of her fourth husband with a man named Charles Holycross.
Mr. Holycross was a friend of both the Spinogles and told him that, basically made the comment to Mr. Spinogle, if you ever hurt Delpha, you know, I'll hurt you back. It was a comment just made off the cuff, according to Mr. Holycross. Delpha then contacted Holycross later and said, are you serious about that? Would you kill Dennis for $1,000? She had told Mr. Holycross at that point that she had already paid another man $500 to kill Spinogle, but that man had just ran off with her money. Mr. Holycross told her no, he doesn't want any part of this. She contacted him a second time and offered him a cut of the life insurance money if he would kill Mr. Spinogle. No, I'm not interested. I'm not going to do that. Leave me alone.
Delpha denies approaching Charles Holycross.
I had made up my mind that I was going to make this one work, regardless of what. But I endured because I was into things. We had a real nice house. We had a swimming pool and a motorhome. So I thought, well, maybe it was time that I took a little bit of the bad stuff in with the good.
But the cracks in the marriage were becoming increasingly visible to outsiders. And so was the alleged physical abuse.
I just begged her to leave him, but she was scared of him. She said he threatened her if she ever did, he'd look her up anywhere she went.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
She tells him, Dennis has to die, we have to do this.
It got out of hand, and he ended up killing me.
By August of 1993, Delpha Spoonoggle's fourth marriage to Dennis Spoonoggle was rapidly deteriorating.
Delpha was in a marriage she didn't want to be in. The business, the family business, was struggling. She wanted to be rid of Dennis and start anew.
There was a $150,000 insurance, life insurance on Dennis. And there's also evidence to indicate that there was a stormy marriage.
She described Dennis as being an abuser, but my opinion was she was doing it to collect life insurance. She knew exactly what she wanted to do. She knew the people that she could use to get this done. She had tried on two times prior to have Dennis killed.
Police say a determined Delpha made plans for a third attempt to get rid of her husband. This time, she approached Edwin Woodward, an acquaintance who called himself David.
My husband met him at a bar, and he didn't have a place to stay, so he bought him home and let him stay in our motorhome for a couple of days till he found a place to live.
Mr. Woodward worked for the Spinogles in their t-shirt business. He was in a relationship with Delpha Spinogle. They were quite close.
There's some indication that there was some romantic tie between the two defendants.
Well, we're best friends. So when the officer as long as stays in this room, we have had some moments. But basically, we're just best friends.
I don't think she was in love with Woodward, but she knew she had a flunky that would do whatever she told him to do.
Delpha denies any romantic involvement with Edwin Woodward, also known as David.
He was the town drunk.
Woodward, at this point in his life, was an alcoholic. And he basically did whatever Delpha told him to do. She tells him to go wait in the motorhome. She later then comes back out, asks him to come in the house, and tells him, you know, Dennis has to die. We have to do this. And, you know, I want you to kill him. We'll be together. You know, plays on his emotions.
There was a door that was left unlocked, or there was a method by which Mr. Woodward would be able to enter the house.
Spinoggle is asleep in the master bedroom. Woodward then strikes Spinoggle in the head with a baseball bat, practically severing the ear off the side of his head.
Mr. Spinoggle lost consciousness for a brief period of time, but he didn't die.
Mr. Spinoggle gets up, and a fight then ensues between Woodward and Spinoggle. Mr. Spinoggle's fighting for his life at this point, and he is able to gain control of Woodward, who drops the bat. Delpha then comes around, picks the bat up herself, and hits Mr. Spinoggle on the back of the head. Woodward then obtains a knife and begins to stab Mr. Spinoggle.
The medical examiner's report revealed multiple stab wounds, none of them lethal. It is estimated the attack went on for 4 torturous hours.
He knows what he's doing, but his heart's not really into stabbing Mr. Spinoggle. But Mr. Spinoggle still won't die. At this point, Mr. Spinoggle makes it out of bed and is crawling on his hands and knees out in the hallway.
According to Woodward, Delpha finally ordered him to retrieve a piece of rope from the garage.
He brings some rope in. They put it around Mr. Spinoggle's neck, and they each take one end of the rope and begin to pull. At that point, Mr. Spinoggle dies.
Delpha tells a very different story, one that begins with her husband coming home at 2 a.m. on a night when the children were away with family. Delpha says Dennis was drunk and forgot to lock the front door. Soon after, he passed out.
After we went to bed, I heard this loud noise, and Dave had hit Dennis in the head with a bat. And he had told me prior to this that he was going to teach Dennis a lesson for abusing me. It got out of hand, and he ended up killing me.
But authorities believe Delpha was in charge every step of the way, even organizing the disposal of her husband's body.
They wrap Dennis's body in the blanket. They drive west till they get to this location, to this low water bridge, and Delpha basically tells him to stop here. She tells him then to dump the body.
Detectives also theorize that Delpha wanted the body to be found. Without it, there would be no insurance money.
Delpha had planned ahead of time. She knew that she was going to have to report him missing. And that's when Delpha directed him to go back down and reposition the body because it couldn't be seen very easily from the edge of the bridge. After they dump the body, they drive back. They're going to go back to the house. He later tells us Delpha gave him a $20 bill to go in and buy a 12-pack of beer and let him keep the change. That was all he ever gained out of the homicide itself.
Delpha described herself as powerless and terrified that she might be next.
And he drives back, tells me that if I tell anyone that he'll kill me and my kids. So I didn't tell anyone.
Police point to evidence showing that Delpha went to great lengths to cover up the crime. In the days that followed, the blood-spattered hallway and bedroom were repainted and the carpets professionally cleaned. Delpha also filed a false missing persons report.
I want them to know that he's missing, he's out there. I couldn't say, hey, he's under a bridge dead, because I feared for my kid's life.
It was on a Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock that we got a call from the Arkansas City Police Department, Arkansas City, Kansas. They had received information from an informant that Edwin Woodward had been up there, and he made statements how he'd have been involved in a killing in Edmond. So we began searching missing persons. Sunday afternoon, when the news reports that the county sheriff's office has located a body, it's unidentified and it's west of our city.
The amount of insect activity on this body was horrendous. He'd been here for a while in August, and he was being totally consumed. It wouldn't have been too much longer. All we would have had would have been a skeletal remains.
Woodward had to work his way down, pull him back, and the medallion fell off. And that's where the good Lord intervened and made sure there was a clue left for us.
Woodward was brought in for questioning.
Well, my friend, and I'm not sure. Well, I'm fine. I don't know you. You know, I'm finished the body. If you're going to be honest, I'm done.
At that point, Woodward broke down and then began to tell us how, at her suggestion, planned and carried out the homicide of Mr. Spinagle.
And at that point, everything just went totally reversed in my head.
Authorities wasted no time in contacting Delpha Spoonagle.
They called to ask me if I would come to the police station and talk to him. And they said they'd found Dennis's body. So I was relieved. So I go in and they start telling me that Dave, they had arrested him and he confessed to killing Dennis. And then he told them that I had asked him to do it. I was shocked at his interpretation. I didn't have anything to do with it. I was a bystander and a victim as far as it all goes.
Both Delpha and Woodward were arrested on charges of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. Delpha was also charged with solicitation to commit murder.
This was such a horrendous crime, where they beat him with baseball bats, they stabbed him, they strangled him, and then took him out and dumped his body out in a bar ditch where it would not be found for several days. I could not think of any punishment that would be adequate in a case like this other than the death penalty.
Mr. Macy was known as a law and order district attorney. No frills, no thrills. In his opinion, from the public interest, he sought justice. In this case, he felt justice was putting both individuals on death row.
I also wanted to send a message out to the other women in Oklahoma County that if you want to get rid of your husband, the proper place is in the divorce courts.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
It was a big shock when they came back with the death penalty.
And later in the program, a robbery turns to murder.
He was like, oh my God, I think I killed somebody. Yeah, he was shaking, and I'm like, oh my God. And we was both scared, so we started doing more drugs.
In February of 1995, Delpha Spoonagle was on trial for the murder of her husband, Dennis Spoonagle. Based on the evidence presented and prosecutor's argument that Delpha's motive was to collect the proceeds from Dennis's life insurance, the jury convicted Delpha and her co-defendant, Edwin Woodward, of first-degree murder.
The case was well put together, well investigated. All the questions that had been asked had been answered. The evidence was just overwhelming that these two people had committed this murder. And my response was to go ahead and try to get the most severe punishment I can.
Woodward was given life without parole. Delpha received the death penalty and became the seventh woman ever on Oklahoma's death row.
They never gave her a chance to tell her story. She never got up on the stand. The lawyer wouldn't even hardly ask questions.
She had a large amount of family. They thought that she would go home. They actually had brought a change of clothes for her.
Well, I just thought I wasn't going to live. I just thought I was just going to pass out there right then when I heard it.
So it was a big shock when they came back with the death penalty. I never dreamed I could end up in something like that.
Even if Dennis was not a good husband, he didn't deserve to be beaten, stabbed, and choked to death and tossed off a bridge.
On April 10th, 1995, Delva was transferred to the maximum security prison, Mabel Bassett Correctional Center, in McLeod, Oklahoma, where she began serving her sentence on death row.
Death row was the most frightening thing I'd ever been through. When I got there, two women had been there 9 years. One had been there 6. One had been there 14. So I just knew that all I had to look forward to was death. There was nothing to do except sit and think about everything.
We reached out to her family even more, her kids. We stick together, even through the rough stuff. We'll stand by her and continue to love her more, not less, by what happened.
And I had turned against God because I thought, how did he let this happen to me, you know? And I realized he was all that could help me. And I turned my life over to him.
2 years after the original verdict, the State Court of Criminal Appeals overturned Delpha's conviction. The court gave Delva the opportunity to again stand trial.
I wanted to go back to trial so that my side of the story could come out, because I never was able to take the stand before. It had been 5 years since I'd touched my kids, and there was hope, you know, then of being able to hug and love them again.
But in October 1998, Delva chose not to stand trial.
My attorney advised me not to. She said, you've got the same DA and the same judge. There were the chances of getting the death penalty again.
Instead, she pled guilty to first-degree murder in exchange for a life sentence without parole.
So she talked me into taking a plea bargain. And I didn't realize how long life without was.
Delva got life without parole, and she will be in prison the rest of her life. But I still wanted her held accountable, seriously accountable, for the crime she committed.
I still think death was the appropriate punishment. However, she's going to be, she's got life without parole, so she should never be paroled. And she's locked up with the meanest women in the world.
After 14 years behind bars, Delva says she's used to the routine.
Start my day, get dressed in the morning, clean my room, go out and help clean the pod, spend the afternoon either reading or listening to my radio. In the evenings, I watch TV.
Weekly visits at the prison with her extended family and her children provide a solid support system.
We're closer than we ever have been. I have a 3-year-old granddaughter. She's the light of my life.
Still, Delva's incarceration has taken its toll on her family.
It's hard to know that she's not with her kids. She's not able to be in her granddaughter's life. She's not here to help her mother.
I hope and pray someday that she will get out of there. She don't deserve to even be in there. And everybody practically knows that.
I regret not reporting it. I should have done that the day it happened. That's my biggest regret.
Delva still proclaims her innocence and scoffs at the notion that she killed her husband for insurance money.
I thought it was ridiculous because $100,000 isn't much money, not for the debts that we had.
I think she made a cold-blooded decision to murder her husband to get the insurance. She gambled, she lost. I think she ought to spend the rest of her life in the penitentiary.
The one thing I'd like to say is that you never can tell when you'll be the one behind the bars. So live your life as if it's the last day. Live it to the fullest.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
I didn't think about the family. I didn't think about my daughter. I didn't think about nobody, you know, because I want to get high.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to www.wetv.com. On March 23rd, 1998, a Polish immigrant, Anthony Raffalo, was robbed and stabbed to death on a street corner at 2:30 a.m.
Somewhat close to the scene, they found a large 14-inch knife.
In the days that followed, a rash of similar armed robberies terrorized the neighborhood. When police finally arrested Oswaldo Gonzalez for the crimes, they learned he had an accomplice, Carmen Ortiz, a 26-year-old mother and heroin addict who denied taking part in the killings.
She knew that he had a knife. She knew that he was going to do an armed robbery. And she agreed to act as a lookout.
She's just as guilty of the murder as Oswaldo.
Was Carmen a desperate junkie who simply witnessed the crime? Or did she knowingly help commit a senseless murder?
Yeah, I was too happy growing up. I was just wild. You know, once I got to age 12, I was just running wild.
She was hanging out with her boyfriend and, you know, just doing the wrong things at that age.
Carmen Ortiz's family lived on the north side of Chicago in a diverse area known as Logan Square.
The neighborhood had a very unique mix because we had gang activity as well as we had family living here, Polish immigrants, Hispanics, all within the same area.
We grew up very poor, but we were close.
The oldest of six children, Carmen always had a special bond with her younger sister, Evelyn.
It's like me and her are best friends, you know? She would tell me everything, I would tell her everything. We would never judge each other.
I kind of wanted to be like her at one point because I thought she was so cool.
Outgoing, very spontaneous. She was the leader of the pack.
In high school, Carmen learned she was pregnant and had to face grown-up realities.
At age 15, when I got pregnant, it was hard for me because I was a little girl.
She dropped out of school to raise her daughter, Jasmine, with longtime boyfriend, Carlos.
My sister was so loving to her daughter.
Well, I remember since I was little, she was a very, very good mom. We did everything together. We talked, and she was affectionate, very affectionate with me.
But Carmen admits she juggled the demands of motherhood with a partying lifestyle in which she acquired new, bad habits.
I started using drugs. I just didn't know how to stop. I'd smoke weed and snort cocaine at that age.
When her drug use graduated to heroin, Carmen's life began a rapid downward spiral.
I really got hooked to heroin when I was 24. And that's when my life changed.
She became addicted as hard as anybody I've ever seen.
I was trying to get high to forget the problems, and I was like happy, and then once it wore off, I'd be sad again, and you know.
The heroin addiction put a strain on Carmen's relationship with Jasmine's father.
They argued a lot. My father, he wanted her to, you know, to stop using drugs. He couldn't take it anymore, so he just left.
Other friends and family became alarmed at the drastic change in Carmen.
You know, I was scared. I was scared, you know, because I didn't understand it. I was like, you know, she's a whole different person.
You looked at her, you could not even recognize her.
And she was real thin. Her face was sunken in. She had broken out. She was itching everywhere. And wasn't talking straight. It wasn't her.
Carmen states that her drug habit became all-consuming, and she pulled away from everyone.
We just kind of judged Carmen at the time. And, you know, we accused her. You know, you're not taking care of your daughter. What the heck is going on in your apartment? You know, why don't you clean this place?
I didn't think about the family. I didn't think about my daughter. I didn't think about nobody. You know, just, I want to get high. I want to do this.
I was angry at her because I knew that wasn't her. She was a different person, and I just felt it.
Carmen met Oswaldo Gonzalez at a party in January of 1998. He was a former gang member and also addicted to drugs.
It's just, you know, hanging out and stuff. Getting high, morning, noon, and night.
Yeah, I knew right away that he was gonna bring my mom into a lot of trouble.
Osvaldo was a heroin addict. He had no compunction about using force to get what he wanted to feed his heroin addiction.
Carmen's daughter says her mother routinely disappeared for hours with Osvaldo.
I used to be scared for her. I used to think that she would be dead at night.
Jasmine's father finally took full custody of the 10-year-old, and Jasmine moved in with him. Carmen regrets that not even losing her daughter could break the stranglehold drugs had on her.
I was just lost. I wasn't thinking right. You know, my mind was just gone.
Carmen's sister, Evelyn, didn't know how far gone her sister was until she came face to face with her in front of a local restaurant.
I'm sitting in my car and I see someone's trying to approach me, but it's kind of common in Logan Square where people will do stuff like that. They want to come up to you and ask you for spare change.
I was walking and I was trying to get some drugs.
You know, this person's coming up to me with a hoodie and I don't see this person's face, but when it gets close to my car, I noticed that it was my sister Carmen asking me for change.
I see my sister and it's just like my heart dropped. I was like, man.
I said, Carmen, what are you doing? And it, you know, I started crying there and she cried and I got out of my car and I just wanted to hug her and so I knew it was time for me to stop judging her.
Like she wanted to help me and hug me. And I didn't want her to see me like that, so I was just like trying to brush her off, you know.
She said, I'm sorry, Evelyn. I love you, I'm sorry. And she walked away so fast.
Over the next few days, Evelyn says she drove up and down Logan Square until she found her sister again.
So I took Carmen in to my apartment. And I gave her clean clothes and a clean towel, and I cooked her favorite dish. I made her bed.
I did go to her house, but then I left because I just wanted to go and get high.
Carmen returned to the streets where she and Osvaldo needed quick cash to buy drugs.
We started doing robberies.
I mean, the usual robbery back then, $70, $50, $100. I mean, relatively low amount of money.
But it was enough to buy 6 bags of heroin that Carmen claims was her daily habit.
A lot of their robberies happen in a 2 to 4 block radius from their apartment, which is directly behind us over on Sawyer.
Police files state that Osvaldo armed himself with a butcher knife hidden up his sleeve. He also preferred to target Polish or Hispanic immigrants along Milwaukee Avenue in the Chicago neighborhood.
They won't complain to the police if they're robbed because they're afraid of getting deported.
Carmen recalls that at 10 p.m. on March 22nd, Osvaldo accosted a man outside of a Blockbuster while she stood nearby, but the victim ran away. The pair grew more desperate as they walked up and down the strip. Around 2:30 in the morning, Carmen says Osvaldo pointed out their next victim.
He seen this man standing at the corner store by himself. I think he was drunk a little bit.
What she was supposed to do was stand on the corner, look out for the police if she spots the police or someone coming to yell to Osvaldo.
I was waiting across the street. He told me to wait, and I looked over there, and he was fighting with Ozzy, and I'm looking around the streets, you know, for cops or, you know, people.
Osvaldo stabbed this guy in the stomach, and he dies there right in the sidewalk.
The guy fell on the floor. So I was like, oh my God, but what happened? What'd you do to him? And he's like, nothing. Come on, let's go, let's go.
When Women Behind Bars continues, Carmen's partner assaults a judge.
The next thing I know, he's lunging at me, trying to cut my face or stab me in the neck with a knife. The knife was a long knife.
Thank you. In March of 1998, two heroin junkies, Carmen Ortiz and Oswaldo Gonzalez, went on an armed robbery spree to pay for their drugs on the streets of Chicago. One of the robberies went terribly wrong and ended in the murder of a family man who had recently immigrated to America from Poland.
Oswaldo stabbed this guy in the stomach. I mean, that's a painful injury. And he dies there right in the sidewalk.
It stayed in my mind that he was on the floor. This image right there just stayed in my mind.
Police records show that Oswaldo discarded the butcher knife, and both he and Carmen fled back to her apartment.
He was like, oh, my God, I think I killed somebody. Yeah, he was shaking, and I'm like, oh, my God. And we was both scared, so we started doing more drugs.
Detectives arrived on the scene, they cordoned off the area, and in a wastebasket somewhat close to the scene, they found a large 14-inch knife. I'm guessing a blade had to be a good 9-inch blade.
Police had the murder weapon, but no other leads to who committed the killing. Carmen says she wanted nothing more to do with Oswaldo after the incident.
I was so scared. I thought he was going to kill me. You know, I said something. I was just so scared.
Despite her fear, Carmen admits she met up with Oswaldo the next day to feed her daily drug habit. They held up a small grocery store on Belmont Avenue.
This was a store in her neighborhood, close to where she lived.
They had done robberies together before. They knew what part they were going to play.
He held a knife on the store owner or manager and said, open the cash register. They got away with some money, but the store person knew her because she had shopped there.
Carmen says that within hours, the two were out of drugs again and prowling the streets for someone else to rob.
This lady was coming out from work, and I was with Oswaldo, and he told me to wait here. I'm gonna, you know, rob this lady. I took the purse, and then we both ran.
All the robberies appeared to be related due to the fact that they were all occurring around the same time, the same area, the same methods.
Ortiz claimed she finally stopped taking part in the crimes, while Oswaldo continued his knife-wielding attacks over the next several days. On the morning of April 10th, 1998, luck ran out for Carmen's partner when he attacked a circuit court judge on his way to work.
I was on my way to the Logan Square station. That's where I catch my subway in the mornings.
Approximately at this location is where Ozzy had accosted him and robbed him and stabbed the judge.
The next thing I know, he's lunging at me, trying to cut my face or stab me in the neck with a knife. The knife was a long knife. It's a carving knife. He punctured my lung. He stabbed me right through the back, right through a lung.
A neighbor in her car witnessed the crime and bravely intervened.
She starts honking the horn. She rolled the window down and she said, leave him alone, leave him alone. And then she honks the horn.
Oswaldo took off running, leaving Judge Delgado seriously wounded.
We got the message that the offender was running southbound from the location where the robbery happened. Gonzalez comes out of the alley running, and he proceeds towards the street.
Well, he stumbled about here. When he saw us, he dropped the knife right about where the curb is. We were able to detain him right there.
Police knew Oswaldo Gonzalez had attacked the judge, but they didn't yet realize he was also the killer of Anthony Rafala. 2 days later, detectives arrested Carmen separately for the Belmont store robbery, where she had been identified.
They arrested her and didn't question her for about 24 hours because she was so strung out on drugs.
Carmen claims she was suffering badly from heroin withdrawal while in custody.
She was vomiting, she had chills, she had the shakes, all the withdrawal symptoms that you're going to get from coming off of a heroin Jones.
It was terrible. I was sick, so sick.
When she finally sat down with police, Carmen confessed to the store robbery and then surprised detectives by admitting she was an accomplice in the Rafalo murder as well.
What she told us was that Oswaldo spotted this guy walking down the street, accosted him, tried to get money from him. When the guy resisted, Oswaldo stabbed him. Gradually, she said that she actually participated in it and in fact acted as a lookout.
Both Carmen Ortiz and Oswaldo Gonzalez were charged with murder and armed robbery and sent to Cook County Jail to await trial.
I was at home. It was in the evening. My friend calls me and says, please don't tell me that that's Carmen on TV. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Carmen's defense attorney tried to get the confession thrown out. He argued that Carmen was under the influence of drugs when police questioned her.
I totally believe it was a coerced confession. I don't believe that it was given knowingly. The judge denied the motion.
Carmen's confession was a hurdle the defense could not get past.
Once the judge ruled that that statement could be evidence in the trial, there was no defense at that point. She knew that he had a knife. She knew that he was going to do an armed robbery. And she agreed to act as a lookout.
Once she agreed, that was her purpose there, was to be a lookout for the police. And of course, she was culpable in the crime. She's just as guilty of the murder as Osvaldo.
If you're there and you in any way aid, abet, further the criminal design or intent, or participate in the proceeds, you're in it up to your neck, okay? You're in for the penny, you're in for the pound, literally.
I was like, oh my God, I ain't never gonna see, you know, the outside no more.
When my sister was sentenced, we cry a lot because I didn't think it was fair. But when I heard the other family speak, there was a murder, you know, and it was a family man. He had children.
If they hadn't been involved with heroin, either one of them, would this have occurred? I don't think so. It's not an excuse because they both knew what they were getting into, but that habit became all-consuming for both of them.
Carmen was incarcerated at the Lincoln Correctional Center in Illinois.
We lived 20 females in a dorm, bunk beds. I got the bottom. I got my TV and my radio and my Bible, so I'm okay with that.
Evelyn took in her sister's daughter, Jasmine, and helped raise her.
I'm so close to her because she's just been so great to me. She looks exactly like my mom, so it's like looking at my mom.
Both Evelyn and Jasmine visit Carmen as often as they can, but Carmen says it is painful not being there for her daughter's life.
I always write her and encourage her. I always did that since the day I got locked up.
It was hard for me knowing that my mom wasn't there for me for my graduation, but I knew that she was proud.
I never got to graduate from high school, so she made me proud in it. I was like, man, my baby's doing it, you know?
In prison, Carmen has overcome her addiction to drugs and says her life is now under the influence of God. Still, Carmen says she lives every day with regret for her part in Anthony Raffalo's murder.
I feel really terrible about it now that I look at it. You know, it was wrong what I did, so just gotta do my time.
Carmen will be released from prison in 2.5 years. She looks forward to being reunited with her daughter and family.
I would call it my big celebration day. My sister comes out, she's paying for what she did, and she found forgiveness in her heart.
There's so much I miss, you know, with her, so. And my family, you know. So I just want to do the right thing this time and be more into my family, you know, and good friends.